Section 4 of The Testament of Beauty by Robert Bridges. This Legimus recording may be freely used and adapted as long as Legimus and the reader are credited. Book 2, Selfhood, Part 1. The vision of the seer who saw the spirit of man. A chariot he beheld, speeding twixt earth and heaven, drawn by winged horses, and the charioteer thereon, upright, with eyes upon the goal and mind alert, controlling his strong steeds, that spurned the drifted cloud, as now they sank, now mounted, in their heavenward flight. Thus Plato recordeth, how Socrates told it to Phaedrus, on a summer morning, as they sat beneath a lofty plane tree, by the grassy banks of the Ilissus, talking of the passions of men. The vision of the seer is truth's apocalypse, it needeth for our aid a true interpreter. The names of the two horses are Selfhood and Breed. The charioteer is reason, and the whip in his hand is not to urge on the steeds, nor to incite their blood. Their mettle is everlasting, and they need no goad. He wieldeth it to make them ware of his presence, and hold them obedient to the rein of his will. But this picture, drafted in mind's creative cave, and thence on the eye projected, thin is as the film of colour and shade on a canvas, there is naught beneath. It telleth not who bred those wild horses, or broke their strong necks to the yoke, nor who builded the car, and harnessed them thereto for its high heavenly flight, nor how reason ever mounted it in full career and took the reins, nor of what stuff intangible they are woven, those reins pictured so taut in his grasp. Nay, for not he himself kenneth well of these things. Yet truly is he portrayed fearless and glad of heart, his lash circling o'erhead, as smiling on his steeds, he speaketh to them lovingly in his praise or blame. Now these two horses, without which the wheels of life would never have had motion, and with them can have no rest, are the animal instincts in the birthright of man. Nor are they, as Plato fancied, one evil and one good. Both are good, but of their wildness they are restive both and wilful, nor will yield mastery unless they feel the hand of expert manage and good horsemanship. Selfhood is the elder and stronger, but Breed, once her foal, is livelier and of limb finer and more mettlesome, her rival now, and both will pull together as one. 'Tis first to tell of Selfhood, since the first one thing, if ever a first thing were, was of the essence of self. Consider a plant, its life, how a seed, fallen to ground, sucketh in moisture for its germinating cells, and as it sucketh, swelleth, till it burst its case, and thrusting its roots downward, and spreading them wide, taketh tenure of the soil, and from every raindrop on its dribbling passage to replenish the springs, plundereth the freighted salt, while it pricketh upright with its flagstaff or head for a place in the sun, anon to disengage buds that in tender leaves unfolding may inhale provender of the ambient air, and tentacles or tendrils, they search not blindly, but each one headeth straightly for its readiest prey. And haply, if the seed be fallen in a place of darkness, roofed in by men, if there should be any ray or gleam, how faint soe'er, 'twill crane and reach its pallid stalk, pushing at the crevice even to disrupt the stones. 'Tis of such absolute selfhood that it knoweth not parent nor offspring, and will abuse advantage of primogeniture, with long luxuriant boughs crowding in vainglory to overshadow and quell its younger brethren, while, as for its own children, that, cradled on its branches, fell from its fruitage, 'twill choke them when they strive to draw life at its feet. Look now upon a child of man when born to light, how otherwise than a plant sucketh he and clutcheth, how with his first life-breath he clarioneth for food, craving, as the blind fledglings in a thrush's nest, that perk their naked necks, stiff as a chimney-stack, food funnels, like as hoppers in a cornmill gaping for what supply the feeder may shovel in their throats. How differeth the newborn child from plant or fledgling? Among low organisms, some are called animal for being unrooted, else inseparable from plants. Yet each, in his small motion, is as a lion on prowl, or as a python gliding to seize and devour some weaker self, whereby to fortify his own. And if selfhood thus rule throughout organic life, 'tis no far thought that all the dumb activities in atom or molecule are like phenomena of individuate selfhood in its first degrees. This autarchy of selfhood, which we blame not at all in plants, and scarcely in brutes, is by reason denounced heartless, and outlawed from the noble temper of man, the original sin and cause of half his woes and shames, whence nature again would seem at variance with herself, misdoubting the foundation whereon she had built all, and seeing too late the fault threatening to split her house would buttress it with the outwork of an afterthought. But though 'tis only reason can govern this horse, correction awaited not the human charioteer. Selfhood had of itself begotten its own restraint, like as small plague microbes generate their own toxin in antidote of their own mischief, so 'tis said, even among beasts of prey, the bloody wolves, who found some selfish betterment from their hunting in packs, had thereby learned submission to a controlling will, their leader being so far charioteer of their rage. While pastoral animals, or ever a drover came to pen them for his profit, had, in self-defence, herded together, and on the wild prairies are seen, when threatened by attack, congregating their young within their midst for safety, and then serrying their ranks in front-line compact to face the dreaded foe. And this parental instinct, though it owned cousinship with breed, was born of selfhood. A nursing mammal, since she must feel her suckling a piece of herself, will self-preserve and shelter it as herself, and oft 'tis hard to wean. So birds, by long brooding inured, will watch their chickens heedfully, and fearfully attend their early excursions, guiding, aiding, and at need defending against danger. It is pretty to mark a partridge, when she hath first led forth her brood to run among the grass tussocks or hay stubbles of June, if man or beast approach them, how to usurp regard she counterfeiteth the terror of a wounded bird draggling a broken wing, and noisily enticeth or provoketh the foe to follow her in a vain chase, nor will she desist from the ruse of her courage to effect her own escape in loud, masterful flight, until she have far decoyed hunter or blundering hoof from where she has bid her little ones to scatter and hide. In man, this blind motherly attachment is the spring of his purest affection and of all compassion, the emotion most inimical to war. I deem its form of unimpeachable sincerity to be the mould wherein friendship's full faith is cast. But richest fruits are tardy in ripening, and man's mind, on the last topmost branch, fed from the deepest root, struggleth slowly to birth through long enforced delay. See nature's habit now devolving upon man, and in his reason her patience as virtue reborn. First will be many months of bodily helplessness, then many years ere the fine budding spirit unclose, wherewhile a new spiritual personality in its miraculous significance, the child is less the mother's own than a treasure entrusted, which she can never love too fondly or serve too well. Nay, rather is she possessed by her own possession, and in her vita nuova such things are revealed that all she hath thought or done seemeth to her of small worth. The unfathomable mystery of her awakened joy sendeth her daily to heaven on her knees in prayer, and, watching o'er the charm of a soul's wondering dawn, enamoureth so her spirit, that all her happiness is in her care for him, all hope in his promise, and his nobility is the dream goal of her life. In the sunshine of her devotion, her peace and joy are mirrored in the child's mind, and would leave thereon no place for sin, could all be purified to attain. But in the most the mind is gross and the spirit bleak, and for a generation needing an outward sign of this transcendent mystery, 'twas well when art, fashioning a domestic symbol in worship of Christ, pictured him as an infant in his mother's arms, sharing with her his suffering and glory. It was well. Nor count I any scripture to be better inspired with eternal wisdom or by insight of man than the four words wherewith the sad penitent hymn calleth aloud on Mary standing neath the cross. Ea mater, it saith, mater fons amoris. Leave selfhood now in her fond sanctuary awhile, with the unseen universe communing, and entranced strangely, as when a high moon through the rifted rack gleameth upon the random of the windswept night, or as a sunbeam, softly, on early worshippers, at some rich shrine kneeling, stealeth through the eastern apse, and on the clouded incense and the frescoed walls mantleth the hush of prayer with a vaster silence, laden, as 'twere, with the unheard music of the spheres. Nay, incommunicable and beyond all compare are the rich influences of those moments of bliss, mocking imagination or pictured remembrance as a divine dream in the vaulted slumber of life. Leave we selfhood now secretly under that nimbus, fashioning by nurture in a new selfhood of spirit, whatever in the redemption of beauty and dignity ennobleth the society or the person of man. Leave that nursery awhile, and ask how nature wrought where she withheld from life the gift of motherhood. The teeming progeny of such egg-breeding insects as multiply their children a thousandfold a day must lie close on the zero of parental bondage, nor can they be debarred by ignominy of rank or unlikeness of kind from vouching in this case. For among bees and ants are social systems found so complex and well-ordered as to invite offhand a pleasant fable enough, that once upon a time, or ever a man was born to rob their honey-pots, bees were fully endowed with reason, and only lost it by ordering so their life as to dispense with it, whereby it pined away and perished of disuse, which, whether it were or no, if man can judge of bees, well might be in their strange manner of life, so like it is with what our economical bee-minded men teach as the first intelligential principle of human government, welfare, and happiness. Nay, some have I seen will choose a beehive for their sign, and gloss their sole delusion with a muddled thought, picturing a skep of straw, the beekeeper's device, a mill-owner's workshop for totem of their tribe, not knowing the high goal of our great endeavour is spiritual attainment, individual worth, at all cost to be sought, and at all cost pursued, to be won at all cost, and at all cost assured. Not such material ease as might be attained for all by cheap production and distribution of common needs, were all life levelled down to where the lowest can reach, thus generating for ever in his crowded treadmills man's life were cheap as bees. And we may see in them how he likewise might live, if each would undertake the maximum of toil that is found tolerable upon a day-doled minimum of sustenance, and stay from procreation at that just number of men, hard workers and small eaters, who could crowd on earth under the shadow of this skeleton of happiness. And since life must lose value in diminution of goods, lifetime must also itself be in due proportion abridged, and both diminishings must at some point be stayed, lest by slow loss they come dwindling in the end to naught. Then, when to each single life the allotted span is fixed, the system will be at balance, stable and perfected. The ground-root folly of this piteous philanthropy is thinking to distribute indivisibles, and make equality in things incommensurable. Forged under such delusions, all utopias are castles in the air, or counsels of despair. So Plato, on whose infant lips, as it is told, be settled where he lay slumbering in his cradle, and honoured with their augury man's loan of praise. Even Plato, when he, in fear and mistrust of selfhood, denieth family life to his republicans, fell bruised. Though cautiously depicting Socrates, reluctant to disclose the offensive absurdum of his pretentious premise, when, being forced to admit that in his free community of women and children, no child would ken its parent, no parent his child, he sought to twist the bull's horns with a sophistry, arguing that mother's love and home life being the source of such inestimable good, 'twere wise that law should forbid private property in their benefits. Nay, so 'twould set his state above all other states, were such like indispensable privileges rescued from ownership, and for the general use distributed equally among the citizens. For surely, said he, a bastard nursed in a bureau must love and reverence all women for its mothers, and likewise every woman, being in like default, would love all babies as her only son. Maybe Plato was pleased to launch his whole utopia safely in absolute dreamland, but poor Socrates, on whom he fathered it, was left in nubibus, where Aristophanes in good jest had set him some 20 years afore, and our sophists, who lack claim to any shred of great Plato's glorious mantle of wisdom, have secured a good lien on his bluff. But yet to read the strange riddle of the hiving bees, their altruism and Platonesque intelligence, 'tis enough to suppose that their small separate selves are functioned by the same organic socialism and vital telepathy as the corpuscles are, whereof their little bodies are themselves composed. That this cell habit, spread throughout to a general sense, inspireth them in their corporate community. Consider the tiny egg cell whence the man groweth, how it proliferateth freely, as a queen bee doth, and more surely than any animal or plant breedeth. How each new offspring cell is for some special work differentiated and functioneth spontaneously, and even will change its predetermined faculty when accidental environment maketh a call, leaving its proper sphere to amend what hath gone wrong. Consider then their task, those unimaginable infinite co-adaptations of functioned tissue, correlated delicately in a ravelled web of unknown sensibilities. How it is a task incomparable in complexity with whatsoever the bees can boast, nor do the unshapely cells behave with lesser show of will, nor of purpose and skill. Pass by the rarer achievements, yea, forget all fames, all works, all art, all virtue and knowledge. Set them by, and still the solved problems must exhaust our wonder. Reason can bring no more, and it addeth nothing that the complete insect should in some part possess some of the faculties of its constituent cells. Or if this thing be deemed in nature anomalous, that perfect organisms with sense and motion endowed should still behave to each other as linked constructive cells, yet outwardly, to our eyes, this freedom affordeth machinery whereupon common purpose can work. To the insect, order and disorder are exposed to sight. And so we think to see the little emmets confer, unlocking their antennae immediately, transmit the instinctive calls which each and all can feel, whereas the mutual fellowship of distributed cells hath so confounded thought that explanation is fetched from chemic agency, because in that science the reaction of unknown forces is described and summed in mathematic formulae pregnant of truth, and of such universal scope that, being called laws, their mere description passeth for efficient cause. End of section 4.